This is RTE Radio 1. Tonight, in tribute to Seamus Heaney, who died on Friday, we replay a public interview with him and his friend and fellow poet, the late Denis O'Driscoll, conducted by Vincent Woods at the Abbey Theatre some years ago. The event was to mark the publication of Denis O'Driscoll's book, Stepping Stones, Interviews with Seamus Heaney, and was first broadcast on The Arts Show in November 2008.
Hello and welcome to the Abbey Theatre and this special edition of The Arts Show, marking and celebrating the publication of Denis O'Driscoll's book, Stepping Stones, Interviews with Seamus Heaney. The title, Stepping Stones, coming from Seamus Heaney's Nobel Prize speech, where he talked of a journey into the wildness of language, a journey where each point of arrival, whether in one's poetry or one's life, turned out to be a stepping stone rather than a destination. The book shaped over many years, many conversations, interviews and letters, now giving us over 470 pages of insights, memories, meticulous observations. The story of a life lived and being lived in passionate engagement with poetry, with language, with literature, with people, with everything that makes a life. Oh, and some great photographs as well. Denis O'Driscoll himself, of course, one of the country's finest poets and commentators on poetry, the ideal Boswell to our own many times doctored Seamus Heaney, and the book An Ideal Companion to the Poetry. Please welcome Seamus Heaney and Denis O'Driscoll.
Thank you very much. This is called the Laggan's Road. The Laggan's Road ran for about 3/4 of a mile across an area of wetlands. It was one of those narrow country roads with weeds in the middle, grass verges and high hedges on either side, and all around it, marsh and rushes and little shrubs and birch trees. For a minute or two every day, therefore, you were in the wilderness. But on the first morning I went to school, it was as if the Queen of Elfland was leading me away. The McNichols were neighbours, and Philomena McNichol had been put in charge of me those first days. Ginger hair, freckled face, green gym frock, a fae if ever there was one. I remember my first sight of the school, a couple of low-set Nissen huts raised their corrugated backs above the hedges. From about 1/4 mile away, I could see youngsters running about in the road in front of the buildings and hear shoutings in the playground. Years later, when I read an account of how the Indians of the Pacific Northwest foresaw their arrival in the land of the dead, coming along a forest path where other travelers' cast-offs lay scattered on the bushes, hearing voices and laughing and calling, knowing there was a life ahead up in the clearing that would be familiar, but feeling at the same time lost and homesick. It struck me I had already experienced that kind of arrival. Next thing, in the porch, I was faced with rows of coat hooks nailed up at different heights along the wall so that everyone in the different classes could reach them. Everyone had a place to hang their overcoat or scarf and proceed to the strange room where our names were new in the roll book and would soon be called. And a little bit later, a good bit later, the wood road. Resurfaced, never widened. The verge as grassy as when Bill Pickering lay with his gun under the summer hedge, night watching in uniform, special militia man. Moonlight on rifle barrels, on the windscreen of a van road blocking the road, the rest of his staunch patrol in profile, sentry loyal, harassing Mulholland's town. Or me in broad daylight, on top of a cart load of turf built neat and tight, looked up to, looking down, allowed the reins like an adult as the old cart rocked and rollicked. Then that August day, I walked it to the hunger striker's wake, across a silent yard, in past a watching crowd, to where the guarded corpse and a guard of honour stared. Or the stain at the end of the lane, where the child on her bike was hit by a speed merchant out of nowhere, hard rounding the corner, a back wheel spinning in sunshine, a headlamp and smithereens. Film it in sepia, drip paint it in blood. This was, is the Wood Road, resurfaced, never widened, the milk-churned deck and the sign for the bus stop overgrown.
Seamus Heaney, a strong theme of journeys and paths there appropriate for this book, Stepping Stones. Can I take you both back to September 2001 when you met in Dennis's place of work in Dublin to discuss the whole idea of and for this book? By then, Seamus, I think you'd agreed in principle to a book of interviews, but it must have been a daunting enough prospect as well.
Well, we had done interviews living, so to speak, but that's, well, with Dennis interviewed before, and there was planned to do a televised interview in Lannan, with the Lannan Foundation. And then this was a suggested follow-up. And the time had come, I thought, to make a record. I mean, people were doing memoirs and this, that, and the other. I had some feeling that I would never actually get around to doing a memoir. And the poems I had written were autobiographical anyway. So I was in two minds. But I came down to one mind when I knew Dennis was interested, because no one knows my work better, no one is more informed about poetry in the world, really, than Dennis, or world poetry. So that was a privilege, and I knew it would be safe, and I especially if he would agree to me writing a lot of the answers.
Which I believe he did. Dennis, what prompted the concept for Stepping Stones? I know you'd looked at other books as well. And I have to tell people that the first line of your introduction is, a wise man's wisdom needs to be extracted.
Well, listening to Seamus reading those poems about roads, I suppose I could keep up that metaphor and say that while there were wonderful interviews with him, they were fairly short. They only had time to explore the main roads. And I thought such an extraordinary life must have gone down a lot of by roads and back roads, and maybe even one or two unapproved roads. So I thought, well, maybe it's time that somebody explored these, and like a policeman guarding an unapproved road could ask some searching questions of this man, who he was, where he came from, and where he got his poetic license from. And that really was the initial impulse, was a great admiration for the interviews he'd done, a wish to sustain some of these for longer, to keep the conversation going, and also a love of the interview form. And I had done quite a few interviews with people, including one of the famous Paris Review interviews with Les Murray, the Australian poet. So that was quite an extensive interview as well. So I was ready, but I certainly was not presuming that Seamus Heaney would either have the time or the inclination. But I did feel somebody should extract the great man's wisdom.
Seamus, I want to talk in a while about some of the poems that were born from this process, and you've read one of them earlier. This process, I suppose, of remembering and articulating memory for the interview. And you've called the book a potent stirrer of memories. But could I ask you to read from the opening section of the book, the section Bearings, from Home to School. And there Dennis asked you to take him and us, the readers, on a guided tour around your first place, Moss Bawn, in Derry. And you did.
Yeah, everything can be recovered with the right prompt. Q&A. Before we talk about your books and how you came to write them, could I take a guided tour around your first place, Moss Bawn, Dennis asks. We're talking about a one-story, longish, lowish, thatched and whitewashed house about 30 yards in from the main road, parallel to the road. Somebody riding past on a bike would have seen it through a thorn hedge and a screen of young alder trees growing on a bank just behind the hedge. Beyond the alders was what we called the front garden, and between the front garden and the house was a boxwood hedge. The lane, or loaning, went straight in from the road and formed one end of that front garden. So you walked down the lane with beech trees on either side of you and turned left onto the front street. Then, if you stood facing the front door, you had on your right the front window of the kitchen or living room. Further along on your right was the front window of the upper bedroom. On your left, you had the front window of the lower bedroom, and beyond that, the stable door, since the stable was under the roof with the dwelling house. What kind of traffic was on the road in the 40s? Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that myself.
He's stealing my best.
No. Seriously, I was this one. Cars now and again. Buses backwards and forwards. Morning, noon, afternoon, evening, night. We were on the main route between Belfast and Marrowfield, Belfast and Cookstown, Belfast and Derry, and we're very conscious of the buses, since there was a bus stop at the end of Broke Road, not far from the end of our lane. There were bicycles too, of course, a few regular peddlers and the occasional traveller from further up or down the country. Kathleen Garvin going to her work in Castle Dawson. Paddy McNichol going to do yard work in Gribbons of Annahorish. Are you seamen now and again? But the most spectacular was definitely Master Pollock, a schoolmaster, a recreational cyclist in shorts, pelting along on his racer bike. He always created a bit of a stir. Then there were the lorries, coal lorries, cattle lorries, quarry lorries, sand lorries, door-to-door grocery vans, and butchers' carts. Horses and carts, donkeys and carts even, though they were rare enough, so it goes on.
Yeah, it strikes me that is a process of very meticulous making of memory, you know, bringing memory back. Did it feel like that when you were doing it? I mean, did it feel like dredging something back out of the past?
Well, it didn't feel like dredging, to tell you the truth. It kind of came quickly and delightfully up. It was a great pleasure to me to name those things. As Kavanagh says, naming those things was the love act and its pledge. Pluck out of time the passionate transitory. Those are the passionate permanent, somehow. But it was a delight. And that's why the questions really and truly were total gift, you know.
There's a great word a little later in that section, the group in the byre, a channel for draining cow dung. And somehow that word, with all its richness, seems almost to go to the heart of your language. I mean, do you remember a sense of wonder about words when you were a boy?
Not really. I took all those words for granted, the group and the duchel. I mean, I never know how to give a phonetic representation of that, because you write down D-U-N-G-H-I-L-L, dunghill, which is, of course, English and true enough, but it was called duchel in County Derry. And there were many other words that... But gradually, as time went on, they became a little treasure trove. They became precious counters, paths backwards, inwards, to a very secret, not just a byroad, but a kind of a lay-by.
I mean, do you think those words, that kind of language that came out of the vernacular, in a sense, went on to influence you?
Well, I suppose it, insofar as it's something that I hold on to, maybe it didn't influence me as... I kept it like... Was it Theseus followed the thread that Ariadne... That it led me not to the Minotaur, but to the middle and to the center of inwardness, of first placeness. I don't like using them as kind of badges of authenticity, as swank County Derry words, you know. But I like them when they come up naturally as the right word for the right thing. And then I'm prepared, as I was saying in the interview, to let people be puzzled. I mean, Dennis was saying, you know, who would be the ideal reader here if they come along and they get a word like turf coom, which really means turf mould? And I think you'd find it very hard to find it in a dictionary anywhere. And it appears in one of the poems as coom. So in that case, I'm prepared to let the insider, who maybe there are two or three people buy the book around Leitrim that would know about coom, but the... person in Los Angeles, let them enjoy the phonetic wonder and be estranged for a minute, you know.
And there's a great glossary as well.
Dennis has a glossary, yeah. That's good.
There's a lovely memory and image in the book. You, at the age of about 7, tearing wallpaper off the wall and writing on the wall. Do you remember what you wrote?
I do not remember what I wrote, but I remember picking a little hole. And I like to think of that as the beginning of trying to find a way in and out, which is, after all, what writing is and in the end and in the beginning. It was pink. It was one of those walls that had been whitewashed and distempered and whitewashed and distempered. So there was a kind of coat of about maybe an eighth or a quarter of an inch thick of soft, crumbly stuff. So it was a great joy to...
to pick at it.
To pick at it.
Did you fall in love with words, with poetry, or is that a kind of romantic notion that we attach in retrospect?
I fell in love later on. I've said this so often. I mean, when I went to St. Columb's College, I was enlivened, wordified, brought alive, the nervous system sang a bit when I read Gerard Manley Hopkins. And that was very linguistically alive, and I was very conscious getting verbal goose flesh from those words. And when I started to write, I wanted to make the words thick and physical and lay down their actual substantiality on the page and in the ear and in the sense of touch almost, if possible. So that was there. But then later on, I realized there were other ways of writing and syntax and the pressure of a meter and the pressure of syntax, a sentence going over lines and so on. Oh, that's important too. So I did gradually, I fell in love suddenly and then gradually developed into a kind of wedded relationship with the language.
I don't want to go over the individual collections or indeed follow a chronology of the years. And it's interesting that, as Dennis said, he avoided that too. But looking back now, do you think you were following a clear and fairly determined path through those decades after you left Queen's University in the early 60s? Or was it as much instinct and belief and a kind of determined hope?
Determined hope covers it perfectly. I have said before, there was something magical to me about the sudden surge I had in myself to write poems, 1962. There was Ted Hughes's poems I read. I had been reading Irish poetry all of a sudden, Kavanagh, Montague, Murphy, with a book called Six Irish Poets, Austin Clark. After I left Queen's, I became alive to the contemporary work, John Hewitt and so on. And that wakened me up. And I was extremely lucky in that the first poems I wrote, I sent them out to the Belfast Telegraph. They published them. I didn't know anybody in the trade. So that was reassuring. And then the Irish Times published a poem, Kilkenny Magazine published a poem. And all of a sudden, I had some sense of confidence in however tentative in the thing. Then the Belfast group started. Philip Hobsbawm came in 1963, started the workshop in Queen's in September. That was just 10 months after I published my first poem. So there's a little community gathered up. Then I met Michael Longley, James Simmons, Derek Mahon, Joan Newman. Various people came together. And that was encouragement. But in the meantime, I got quite a few rejection slips from the New Statesman, the Times Literary Supplement, and so on. And it was 1964, 2 years afterwards, that again, something quite magical. Carl Miller at the New Statesman took 3 of my poems, published them in the Christmas issue, and Faber and Faber wrote to me. And I mean, that was unheard of. It was completely like a magic wand. They didn't accept what I sent them, first of all, but they said, try again, which I wrote like a demon in the first 6 months of 1965. So,
what was that feeling like, you know, getting that response from Faber?
Well, completely magical, as I say. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Faber, as I said often and often, it was like an otherworldly address. The great canonical names of 20th century modernist poetry published by them, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Wallace Stevens, and then among the more contemporary people, Louis MacNeice, W.H. Auden, Ted Hughes. The back of the book was a list, and that was otherwhere. It was like a litany of the saints, you know. Were you going to put your own name onto that? So I would never have presumed to send it to them, but the letter came then. I should say, to my disadvantage, that the same, round about the time that letter came and they accepted the poems, T.S. Eliot had died between the first letter and the second one. I don't think that... he, as you know, was a director of Faber and Faber's at the time, but he rarely came in at that stage, I have to say. So. But it would be nice to say that Eliot had vetted the poems, but he didn't, no.
You mentioned Miwash earlier, and you referred to him as this kind of godfather figure in your life. Why was he so important to you?
Well, this is a poet who was born 1911 in Lithuania, in a rural countryside. I grew up, in Arcadia, in a way. Grew up with the subculture of the local Lithuanian life and the actual culture, doctrines, and education of Catholicism, boarding school, and so on. So in the beginning, the life he lived was the same as the life we were still living in the countryside in Ireland in the 1940s. But this man, I felt so intimate with that first life. But then he went on to experience the whole tragedy and change of the world in the 20th century. He went to university in Vilnius, then he went to Warsaw. He was in Paris in the 20s. He went through the kind of Marxist turmoil. Never became a communist, but was naturally tempted by the message of redeeming the world some way, the wretched of the earth getting a better deal. Then he was in Warsaw at the time of the Nazis come. He lives through the Second World War. He lives through the destruction of the ghetto, in the Jewish ghetto. He lives through the uprising. He, for a little while, works with the People's Republic as a kind of functionary of the embassy. Then he ends up in exile in France in the midst of that intellectual turmoil with Sartre and Camus. Also at that time, a friend of Thomas Merton, caught between, as he said, politics and transcendence, between religion and the usual life of the time. And I mean, everything about him, then he ends up in California. So he moves from medieval life, in a way, to the postmodern. And actually, I would say in the last 69 years, something the same has happened to myself. The life we lived was, I mean, you lit the fire, you went to the well, water was an element, fire was an element, smoke was smelt, and then we moved from that to a postmodern world. So I felt at home with his work always, and he's a great poet, great intellectual range, great melody, and so on. Anyway, I could talk with him about him till the cows come home.
Do you yourself ever feel somehow caught between those two extremes, that's between politics and if you like, everyday life, and that engagement and transcendence?
Well, definitely. I mean, I've quoted Miwash all the time. That was why he was so helpful to me. The way he put the things didn't solve it, but having a problem stated coherently and cogently relieves you to some extent. And he said it about his state in the all along 30s, 40s, 50s. He said, I was caught between the contemplation of emotionalist point
and the command to participate actively in history between politics and this transcendence, he said. So that, for people writing in the north of Ireland between the 60s and the 90s, covered it perfectly as far as I was concerned. And negotiating those anxieties, tensions, you look to others for help. There's no help except what you do yourself, but there are rewards in reading how others negotiate it. Yeah.
At once a country of community and a realm of division, your description of your own place, your original home place, do you get back to Derry, back to the north much?
I go back regularly to the home ground around Broach, the wood, Castle Dawson, and I do feel at home there still. I know where I am there better than I know anywhere else. And the names of the people, actually the people whom I thought of as young fellows now, there are people now in their 80s that I think of in their early teens or 20s, so things have changed a bit. And the houses have changed, of course, and the roads have changed, but it is the land of heart's desire to some extent still, yeah.
I think it was Brodsky who said that the only thing poetry and politics have in common is the letter P. I suppose over the years you've been wary, shall we say, of overt political statement or involvement, wary of anything that might be read or used as propaganda. But you're not without political belief or passion, and I would think not afraid to say what you think.
Well, I always believe that, as far as possible, tell the truth, do unto others as you would be done by yourself. And I didn't think there was much need for me to proclaim my position or disposition, because it seemed to me that the cultural markings of my work signified values and commitments. And I mean, let's face it, when the IRA were blowing people up in your name, I wasn't for that. And this is old territory. We could go over to the cows come home. I don't have any anxieties about what happened. The trace element in the poetry and in the prose and in the, the general conduct, I'm content enough with it as it stands. So that's it.
The stroke you suffered in August 2006, you recovered fully and fairly quickly. No impairment, as you say, to speech or memory or vision or humour. But it must have been a fairly profound shock.
It certainly was, yes. I was very lucky, really, to have a lot of friends adjacent the morning it happened. But it was strange. But the stranger thing is that with the reassurance, A, of the friends beside me, and with the excellent arrival of the services, the ambulance and so on, and the treatment in Letterkenny Hospital, I didn't feel threatened. I felt buoyed, in shock maybe. But the experience of being in hospital, I was told, and I knew, I was very, very lucky. Inside 48 hours, my big toe moved. I mean, this was stiff, and nothing was being felt. But it was very, very strange. No signals going anywhere. You might as well have had a goalpost there as a leg, but then inside, as I say, really quite short day and a half, the big toe moved and I was reassured this was going to be okay. And I got from Donegal to Dublin and eventually into the Royal Hospital in Donnybrook, great place. And I realized how lucky I was when my fellow patient in the ward revealed to me how bad it can be in terms of speech, in terms of paralysis, in terms of being in hoists and so on. So it was a learning experience in that way of luck and blessing, really.
Bill Clinton visited you in hospital,
then. Well, he was over here seeing. He was over for to get from the Taoiseach some kind of subscription to the Clinton Foundation, to his foundation. He was also here for the golf for the Ryder Cup. And I mean, that there was some kind of lunch to which I was invited, and I apologized, said I couldn't go, and he obviously heard why I couldn't go. So somebody asked for my number so that he could call. And so I said, well, give them the number. But there was no call. He was going away on Friday morning, so I was quite relieved. Not much to say on the phone. Hi. Although he's a very good talker himself. So Friday morning, I thought, that's that. But the next thing, there was a phone call saying that he was on his way. He had met the Taoiseach at 8 o'clock. He was to go to the airport at 10. So the whole procession with the outriders landed up to, to Donnybrook, and he breezed in, and my fellow patients and I were at our porridge. He was great. He shook hands and he went around the wards, and I mean, very, very affable, very amicable. I had met him a couple of times before. But the great thing was, it was a secret visit. There was no coverage, and, you know, perfect. Well done. I was honored.
And you say that thrillers helped you get through that period. Well, what did you read during that
time? I read a lot of Henning Mankell. Terence Brown introduced me to Henning Mankell's thrillers a while before, and I went through all of them that I hadn't read at that point. I also have to recommend Robert Harris, whom I hadn't read before. I started Donna Leon, too. But I haven't read so many since, really, to tell you the truth. It was the middle of the night job that kept me going, yeah.
You quote Thomas Hardy, if way to the better there be, it exacts a full look at the worst. With, it should be said, the B of better and the W of worth taking capitals. Yeah. You've looked at pain and conflict and division in your own work. And I suppose, you know, we've seen the north of our own country on the way one hopes to the better, capital B or not. Do you feel that your own work of witness over the years has helped at all to reach that path towards the better?
Well, I think everybody is aspiring towards the better. Well, most people anyway, yeah. People don't agree about what the better is quite often. But I would say that I was part of a general hope for betterment. And I'm glad from what people have said about the work and what I've known from private discourse that something occurred, and I am grateful to have been part of that moment, you know. I think that I wouldn't separate myself from a whole movement of the literary movement in this country, north and south. The voices that have been well-disposed, future-seeking, intelligent, ironical, detached, and not fanatical. I mean, that has been the whole movement in terms of drama, in terms of poetry, in terms of fiction. People alive and dead, you know, who have contributed to that. I wouldn't put myself separate from the whole thing.
Do you remain optimistic about the new political dispensation in the North?
Well, I believe it has to work, and I think everybody knows it has to work. Everybody knows it's an achievement. There's a lot of contrariness and old-style resistance, old sectarian energy dormant there, not so dormant still. But it has to work, yes. And I mean, the distinction which I am tired making and quoting, the distinction made by Václav Havel between hope and optimism is one that's worth always remembering. I mean, hope, he says, hope is knowing that something is worth working for. Optimism is thinking everything's going to turn out all right. I would opt for hope in this case and believe that there are definite grounds for hope. There's intelligence abroad, there was just like a bit more vision and jizz in the whole thing, you know? A bit more energy and vision, yeah. Hope for the future.
Will you read another poem for us?
This is called The Harvest Bow. My father made these harvest bows with straw, wheat straw, and they're very, very beautiful little love knots, I suppose. And I got him to make me one in the mid-70s and wanted to wear it because he always wore it quite unselfconsciously in the harvest time. And I put it on me and went into Dublin wearing it, and I thought, uh-oh, can't do that. I felt totally self-conscious. But it was such a beautiful thing. I pinned it up in the dresser, and this poem resulted. Harvest bow. As you plaited the harvest bow, you implicated the mellowed silence in you, in wheat that does not rust, but brightens as it tightens twist by twist into a knowable corona, a throwaway love knot of straw. Hands that aged round ash plants and cane sticks and lapped the spurs on a lifetime of game cocks, hark to their gift and worked with fine intent until your fingers moved somnambulant. I tell and finger it like braille, gleaning the unsaid off the palpable. And if I spy into its golden loops, I see us walk between the railway slopes into an evening of long grass and midges, blue smoke straight up, old beds and ploughs in hedges, an auction notice on an outhouse wall. You with the harvest bow in your lapel, me with the fishing rod, already homesick for the big lift of these evenings, as your stick whacking the tips off weeds and bushes beats out of time and beats, but flushes nothing. That original townland, still tongue-tied in the straw tied by your hand. The end of art is peace, could be the motto of this frail device that I have pinned up on our deal dresser, like a drawn snare, slipped lately by the spirit of the corn, yet burnished by its passage and still warm.
Seamus Heaney reading The Harvest Bow. You're listening to The Arts Show coming from the Abbey Theatre. Our special guest, Seamus Heaney, as we mark the publication of Denis O'Driscoll's book, Stepping Stones, Interviews with Seamus Heaney. Denis, somewhere between autobiography and biography is how Terence Brown describes the book in his review in the Irish Times. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Well, that was certainly the appeal of the book for me, was that one could set about writing an orthodox biography. What I wanted to capture was the man's own language, because, after all, one of the most admirable things about Seamus Heaney is his ability. He's a multitasker, actually, because he's a great poet, great prose writer, great letter writer, postcard writer, and I think speaker and interviewee as well. So there was nothing that I could write of my own accord that would equal the sound of his own voice. And therefore, if I asked enough questions, I was going to get not only a sort of biographical overview, but I was also going to get, incidentally, a memoir. So I would be very happy to think that it not only fell between the two, but it combined both.
Was there anything you were reluctant at all to ask? Did you feel constrained in any way?
No, I truly didn't. I would say that, well, I suppose they say everybody has a book in them. But when people write a book, it's very often a kind of misery memoir. So our sense of disclosure now is so high or so low, I'm not quite sure which the word is, that people think that you're being very cautious if you don't produce some kind of exposé, if there isn't some kind of, you know, exclusive, Seamus Heaney reveals. Whereas it seems to me that every page of this book is a little revelation, a little clue, and also, of course, a magnificent revelation of language itself and its own potential. But I would say that probably because of my own rural upbringing and being similar to Seamus's, I would approach things with a certain decorum and a certain restraint, purely on the grounds of tact, of a proper distance, rather than from any sense of suppression or inhibition. I wasn't in any way inhibited by Seamus from asking anything. I don't think there was anything that I did ask that he wasn't prepared to answer. But yes, there were things that I would not ask. I would not ask you or ask anybody else. And therefore, this may not be, as Ezra Pound might have said, the book that the age demanded, in the sense that that would be an entirely different kind of book. And I think we wouldn't be both on stage at this moment if I had produced that book. But I feel that within those boundaries, which seem very reasonable boundaries to me, that absolutely everything was permitted. And any cutting that was done, and God knows the word cuts is a bit of a demon word at the present, but in books, cuts are actually good things. And I did some editing of the book simply to help the flow of it, or because, to go back to the roads metaphor as well, some of the roads I went down proved to be cul-de-sacs.
There are many wonderful photographs, Seamus. You as a boy, your parents and siblings, your wife, Mary, and your own children, friends and fellow poets. And I suppose this strong feeling somehow that the photos add to the openness of sharing, the sharing of your life, which is, I suppose, seems to be somewhere at the heart of this book.
Well, you know, the photographs, when I looked at the book, I thought, are they too intimate? And Dennis was saying, no, these are good. I mean, and it is true. I feel that the photos of myself as a youngster, the photographs of the wedding, all those things, they're kind of familial. But yeah, the nature of the book and the nature of the responses allowed for that, I think. But just to go back to what you were asking Dennis about disclosure, full disclosure or whatever, I always remember in the 70s, or probably late 60s, early 70s, I used to take a good bit of drubbing from the Honest Ulster Man, which was a very vigilant and mocking magazine at that stage, edited then by a dairyman, very gifted satirist called Michael Foley. And I mean, I was on various kind of arts council advisory committees and this, that, and the other. And I remember Michael called me a Rachman of the arts at that time. I mean, I'd been published and all that. And he had done this verse criticism of the poetry scene. And he said of me, he said, "But Heaney knows he lives in sin." "He smiles and takes his medicine," he said. "But you would need to hear what's said much later to the wife in bed." So he sort of got it in one, as a matter of fact. But there was, yeah. I think that the photos are actually good. There's fessing up to also a kind of public dimension, because there are photographs of Robert Lowell and so on in the book, as well as intimate family photographs, yeah. So you take the medicine for that too.
I suppose on that issue of the public side of things, I mean, every day for years there have been these massive demands on your time, your energy, your private space, you know, books to launch, honours to receive, public work. Do you ever get tired of that? I mean, do you ever feel a need to retreat from it?
Well, I am tired of it at this stage, definitely, yeah. I mean, not this. This is a special moment. But, I mean, I started out as a school teacher, working in a teacher training college, then in Queen's University, Belfast, then having a relationship with schools through Schools Broadcasting in the north. I did a lot of schools visits because I was a teacher myself. I was involved in the business. I was from a local district. I knew that the parish hall needed occasional events. I did a lot of things like that. And really, it moved on from local service, if you like, just part of what you would do as community work, to readings then, and readings became much more popular. And you were on the circuit, and it gradually expanded, and it became, it's your temperament also. I mean, I was capable, I suppose, of doing it. And I ended up doing a lot of readings and so on. But then, yes, I ended up doing too much and cornered. So the one good thing about the stroke was that said, all right, change now. Now is the time for change. And now with, actually one of the things about doing this book also, going up to the very last chapter, is a sense you've got to watch out here. You know, are you closing off already? So I'm kind of torn between doing nothing but doing a wee bit more in case it looks like you're stopped altogether, you know?
Yeah. I suppose we all experience deep pain and inherit legacies of pain. The death of your brother Christopher, a deep pain for you. Did the act of writing about him help to ease that grief?
Well, this was 10 years after it. The grief at the time was bewildering. I was, 13, come home from school. Shocking and grievous and weepy and homesicky and all that. But for my parents, for my mother and father, it was devastating. And for a lifetime after that, when we heard of some accident, somebody having a loss, some sudden death or death in the road, it stirred up the whole thing. And my mother was a deeply empathetic woman anyway. She had a strong sense of others' suffering, and she was very sympathetic. And my father would also have had it, but farmer fathers in the 1940s and 50s were more stoical and less revealing of the inner feelings. So it would have been my mother who had revealed the grief. But I would say that over the years, yes, it healed. But 10 years later, in 1963, in the month of February, which was the anniversary of Christopher's death, I was sitting in the flat in Belfast with two chemistry, biochemists with whom I shared the flat. And we had a rota. One of us would buy the food, one of us would cook it, one would clear up. And week after week, and it was my week to clear up afterwards. So I was sitting in the armchair, and somebody else was getting the food ready. And I wrote the thing down. I remembered Christopher's anniversary coming up. And this, I just wrote it down straight inside half an hour, directly, and maybe I changed one or two words, and that was it. And for that I am eternally grateful. It was accepted immediately by the Kilkenny magazine. I read it, I remember, on the Late Late Show, and it entered common currency, and is now on a lot of school books, and children learn it at school and so on. So I am grateful for that, but I don't like reading it because it looks like riding the rails of a popular poem, and but there it is.
Can I ask you one of the questions Dennis puts to you towards the end of the book, and no altering on my part of its shape? What has poetry taught you?
Well, it's a very hard question to answer. I mean, I said that it taught me that you can tell truth slant, whereas Emily Dickinson said you can tell. Well, you can tell things with truth in them, I suppose, or you can speak truthfully, but you can also speak obliquely. You can speak at an angle to things. But in the age of deconstruction and distrust of language, the age of Derrida, poetry taught me to trust Derry as well as Derrida. You know that that's your subjectivity, which has also been theorized out of existence. Subjectivity is to be guarded, is worth guarding, is where we'll end up, I suppose, if we're lucky enough to keep our memories. So it, the ore of self, the ore of whatever your being, the lining of your being, which is your own strangeness and your own intimacy, poetry can, in a sense, guarantee that for you. And I know from reading other poetry guarantees that for yourself. So if you're lucky, you might be part of the guarantee system of inwardness in the culture and in an autobiography or other people's biography. Yeah.
Wordsworth, you quote, "On this earth we find happiness or not at all." You found great happiness, haven't you, in life and in life's work?
I have to say, yes, that I'm afraid of saying that, of course. I mean, but I have been blessed in both in terms of what has happened to me with my work and what has happened to me with my life, with loved ones, with friends, with family, with the acceptance that my work has gained. And yes, but I don't want to boast about that.
Do you have another poem?
Well, I thought I might read, yes, the poem. I wrote it, this poem, after I got out of hospital. When I was in hospital, the part of the scripture that was very much in my mind all the time was the story of the man sick of the palsy, as they said, who was, I remember, there was a big crowd around Christ and they couldn't get near him. So that his friends carried him up to the roof, took off the slates of this house and lowered him down where he was healed. He took up his bed and walked, famously. What I learned that morning when I was helped to the hospital, or to the ambulance on the stretcher, was that the friends, who are not really mentioned much in the parable or in the story, are the utterly important ones. The hero, of course, is the healer, Christ, and the blessed one is the person who is healed and takes up his bed and walks. But the people who are central to the whole story are the friends who carried him in. So this poem is in gratitude to the friends who carried me in. And in this occasion, at this moment, friend Dennis, who carried me through this book, and all the friends who sustained me, who are here and elsewhere. I could call it miracle. Not the one who takes up his bed and walks, but the ones who have known him all along and carry him in, their shoulders numb, the ache and stoop deep locked in their backs, the stretcher handles slippery with sweat. At no let-up until he's strapped on tight, made tiltable, and raised to the tiled roof, then lowered for healing. Be mindful of them as they stand and wait for the burn of the paid-out ropes to cool, their slight lightheadedness and incredulity to pass, those ones who had known him all along.
Seamus Heaney, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you, and thanks to Dennis O'Driscoll for a work of immense scholarship and application and patience, truly a work of revelation. A stock-taking, as you say, Dennis, the stream, the river itself in full spate. Stepping Stones Interviews with Seamus Heaney is published by Faber & Faber. My thanks to the staff of the Abbey Theatre for their help this evening, and also Declan Heaney of Faber. On sound tonight, Tony Lyons and Martin Moore. Nuala O'Neill produced the programme. From all of us, a very good night.